Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
What is green militarism? To answer this question and more, I am joined today by Esther Mareiner. Dr. Esther Mareiner is an associate professor and political ecologist in the Sociology of Development and Change Department at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands, where she works on nature-society relations in areas of armed conflict. She in particular studies the militarization of nature conservation, processes of environmental change in violent environments, and the intersection between geography, authority, and warfare. Her current research project, Wounded Landscapes, financed by the Dutch Research Council, investigates how forms of slow violence, colonial legacies of violence, and armed conflict reconfigure social environmental landscapes. In addition to understanding the lingering effects of different forms of violence upon nature-society relations, Esther is interested in how these wounded landscapes are understood by a range of different international conservation organizations, critically analyzing their interventions in these spaces. She has been conducting field research in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo since 2013. Currently, most of her research is taking place in Uganda. And in the near future, she will also start field research in Europe. And in the near future, she will also start field research in Europe, such as in the Veluwe, a protected area in the Netherlands. Welcome to the Voices podcast, Esther, and thank you for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Great, we're happy to have you. I am going to start with the big question. What is green militarism? And maybe you can also tell our listeners how you became interested in green militarism.
Thanks, Polly. So if we really want to go into detail about green militarism, maybe I should first explain a little bit what is green militarization, because there's often a bit of confusion between green militarism and green militarization. It's already now, I think, over 10 years ago that Elisabeth Lundström in an article coined the concept of green militarization, which was a concept that really emerged from the ground up from places where nature conservation areas, conservation became a very militarized activity. We saw that around the Paul Kruger National Park in South Africa, where there was a so-called war against rhino poaching that started to emerge. And also other cases around the globe, we saw the conservation became very much a militarized activity on the ground. And that led to quite a large body of literature that we now refer to as green militarization, that really talks about the use of military technologies, actors, and ideas for the pursuit of biodiversity conservation. And we saw that in relation to the rhino poaching crisis, but also to conservation activities in areas of armed conflict, where we see that a lot of counterinsurgency operations starting to become emerged together with nature conservation. And this body of literature was very much empirical based. It became very much from the ground up studies from within political ecology specifically. In the beginning, there were not many international relations scholars interested in, with exception of Rosalind Duffy and a few others for sure. But it was very much from anthropology, from political ecology, that we saw these trends changing around specifically protected areas. But while this work of body green militarization specifically focused on biodiversity conservation, we see now, and there's a growing body of broader literature where we see similar processes, actors, and logics being extended to other environmental issues and specific nature, specific landscapes like forests, seas, and marshes, like swamps, for example. We talk, for example, more and more in daily life about fighting climate change, combating wildlife crime, or even the war against deforestation. And especially in the current geopolitical context, we are also talking more and more openly about how we can weaponize nature, how we can use landscapes to wage war, but mainly now how to prepare ourselves for war. Also within Europe, how can we actually use the environment, use our landscapes by making us resilient and preparing ourselves for war? And it's this broader encapsulating of different natures, of environmental issues within a military mindset that I think is what green militarism is about. And there's a close linkage between what is green militarism, which is more the acceptance, the normalization, the justification that we look about to climate change and something that we need to fight, or that we need to actually use some of our forest as kind of tools in preparing ourselves for war. And it's this normalization and this justification that we look at it to our environments as part of defense strategies that is green militarism. And this then is closely linked because it can lead up to real green militarization, real military buildup on the ground. So I think green militarism takes a lot of place in relationship to geopolitical processes, defense industries, defense actors, and the green militarization where really things happening on the ground, which has a direct impact to the ecologies, to the landscapes, but also the people living around the places that need to deal with this green military buildup. So it's a close relationship between the two, and they're not always easy to distinct. So when we see that nature is being weaponized as a form of environmental warfare, I think it's also very important to say that nothing about this process is very new. Environmental historians of war have showed, and indigenous scholars have showed for years, that actually warfare is always environmental. They always have an ecological impact, but they also use scorched earth tactics, for example, as a tool of war. But the whole range is becoming broader and broader, how the linkages between militarism and greenwashing or greening of the domain, as we also now see the military industries and defense actors are increasingly aiming to present themselves as green, despite their tremendous carbon footprint, their destructive impact on ecologies, as the work of Nico Edwards shows, for example, where she critically looks at how military actors are greenwashing themselves, and that militarization and war can become some kind of environmental friendly touch. Yeah, just to round up around green militarism in different way, how we can see this take a place in different ways, is that by allowing green militarism, we as a society allow the military to extend in domains such as climate change, deforestation, and we contribute to how military power and logics not only become further engraved within society, which is the classical militarism studies, but they also leave this imprint on ecologies and landscapes and people's relationship with those with nature. The question how I became interested in green militarism came very much from my fieldwork for my PhD in and around the Virunga National Park, the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where I really found that militarized conservation was actually aggravating dynamics of armed conflict. And there was a huge discrepancy between the narratives that existed within Europe and the media and policymakers that were actually very fond of supporting the Runga National Park in a very, like, the epic struggle they are fighting, doing kind of the impossible in such a difficult context as Congo, still aiming to protect the mountain gorillas, to protect the biodiversity, and even presenting this as a form of peace building. That's by allowing to actually use development aid for the militarization of conservation by supporting this, that this actually could contribute to peace. And that was very much the international narrative, the international images that existed around this, that legitimizes the use of development aid towards military actors and military technologies. Yet, fieldwork around the Runga National Park very clearly showed that this actually aggravated dynamics of armed conflict and actually took a lot of the rangers within a very difficult context. They were actually put on the front line suddenly and were put in a very dangerous situation to have to expel people out of the park, to limit their access to the park for their livelihoods, which in the end often pushed these people further in the hands of the armed groups and rebel groups, which allowed rebel groups to actually further strengthen the position within the park. So in the end, it didn't really contribute to peace building. And this is how I became very much interested, but my earlier work was very much based on really field work within the Congo, I was more and more interested in the international dynamics behind this. Why are we supporting this? What are the narratives, the images, and a lot of the colonial durabilities of our thinking around who should be able to protect nature, how should nature be protected, and that we have the expertise and we have the know-how, which is often military-inspired, because in the colonial times, conservation also was often very closely aligned with military tactics, because conservation was a tool of political control and dispossession of people from their land. So while conservation always had a very violent colonial past, I asked myself the question, how do we self-allow it that when we talk in around many issues around decolonization, around stopping violence, how come that in the name of conservation, we see still a lot of discontinuities? And this brought me to the international part of the question. And that is why my work is now also really situated on a bit the intersection between political ecology that's really at the foreground of these debates and international relations.
Brilliant. Thank you, Esther. You have this new project, or this project that's been funded for the last few years by the Dutch Research Council, Wounded Landscapes. Can you tell us some more about this Wounded Landscapes project? What was the motivation for the project? How are you researching these wounded landscapes? And what are some of your findings so far?
So in the project Wounded Landscapes, is the first time I stepped a little bit away of making militarized conservation or focusing on conservation as my main focus. And it's a project, a large part of the project I designed together with Professor David Mwambari. He's linked to the University of Leuven, and he's a memory scholar. And together as a political ecologist / critical security studies scholar, we conducted fieldwork together in Burundi and Uganda. And there we actually wanted to see not so much what is the impact of war and genocide and violence, and also still the past colonial violence upon the ecologies on the landscapes. Because within the dominant literature, there's often the discussion, like, is war good or bad for the environment? And it's very much a question from looking at remote sensing technologies, where we actually are mapping the impact of war on the environment, often, of course, coming to the conclusion that war is bad for the environment. But oddly enough, there are also some scholars within mainstream debates that argue war is not always bad for the environment. It can leave some kind of no man places, And that is where nature can actually thrive. And there's also calls for the military training grounds are actually hotspots for biodiversity. And that actually war can actually also make sure that some places are too dangerous for people to enter. And that is actually can be seen as beneficial for the environment. In this project, we really wanted to go beyond this question, is war good or bad for the environment? As we really found that it really overlooked completely people's lived experience within what we call these wounded landscapes. And as a memory scholars and political ecologists going in this fieldwork together, we were looking how people's past memories of violence, going back to the colonial period, but also the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, for example, and also a lot of the ethical violence that happened in Burundi, how people had to flee, how people had to survive, their interactions with the different natures and landscapes during these periods, and how now afterwards, in the aftermath of that, how do they live with these landscapes? How does this impact their relationship with the environment? And how this continues to shape their daily life. But we saw there in the project of these wounded landscapes, we're really looking at how three different forms of violence are impacting nature-society relations, where we look at the very much direct armed conflict component, but we also to see that in relationship to colonial violence and the enduring impact of colonialism on these landscapes, and also forms of slow violence, the violence that's created by climate change, by disasters, but also the slow violence of the long-term health, public health implications of ammunition that is left in the ground, for example, toxicated grounds. And all these different forms of violence are becoming a kind of multi-layered landscapes of violence. And it's not just one incident of war that impacts the ecology, but it's also very much historically built up in different episodes and different forms of violence. And that is where we really looked at how do people now make life in those places, and how this can also be seen as a kind of form of vernacular memory or vernacular landscapes, as opposed to how the state tried to reclaim control over these areas after war, or how the state also claimed specific state sanctions narratives around what happened in the war. And if you look to people's daily lives within these landscapes, you can uncover a lot more vernacular memories, days of actually what people, how people experienced violence, but also how they relate to these places. And we found this very important to look at this, because we see that in a lot of these former militarized or wounded landscapes, that we see new projects emerging that actually don't address this social ecological harm that has been committed, but actually using this and using the violence that has occurred to install new projects like big agro-industrial farms, state-sanctioned memorials places, or also conservation, how some of these areas are now being seen as where conservationists come in and actually trying to claim nature conservation. So you see new forms of militarization. Also, some of them are forms of green militarization, but not all. There's also a lot of other industrialization and economic impacts, and how they address the past and how they're sensitive for this relation. And then the question of conservation only became the question afterwards. Why is this important for conservationists or for international actors going in these areas? And there's one, maybe a very concrete example that helps to explain this process. For example, in the war in Uganda in 86, when it's called the Bush War, where Museveni came into power, it was the war was fought in central Uganda in the Luwero Forest. It was a very forested area which the rebels used to gain into power in Kampala, and a lot of that. Because of the war, but especially after the war, the state was complicit in a lot of the deforestation of the area. A lot of people said, of course, Museveni want to deforest this area because he knows that future rebels could use the same forest to challenge his authority. But he also used the wood for building up his regime and his military power. So it's also the use of the resources for political gains, but also with a counterinsurgency logic in mind. But in this area, then I encountered a conservation actors funded by International Development Aid that said wanted to reforest this area. They wanted to reforest the area and they wanted to plant trees. And they were frustrated and they said, these local people, they don't appreciate forests. They don't know what forest brings. And they're sabotaging the project all the time. And they were really coming to a conclusion. The people here are not environmental friendly. They're just interested in the trees for economic gains. They don't allow a proper reforestation in this landscape. But if you talk with people and ask them, they say, yeah, but if we get a forest again here, we are afraid because forests can hide dangerous elements. And we have lived in these places and we don't want to become the center again of a new counterinsurgency operations, of an insurgency and a counterinsurgency because they suffered so much. And I think to understand these histories are very important before implementing very top-down, sometimes military enforced conservation or environmental agendas that actually would just aggravate the pain and make people relive the past in ways they don't want to.
Thank you. Now, you've started to already sort of mention a few things in your answers so far. But now I have a question about theory. And as I say, you've started to mention a few sort of theoretical engagements that your work touches upon. But what theories are drawn on in researching green militarism? What theories do you draw on in your research? What theories are sort of mainstreamed in the work on green militarism or green militarization?
So the theories or the literature I use, they're very much, it's a combination of different approaches, especially also informing different methodological approaches, how to actually research the long-lasting effects of militarism on the ecologies and people's relationship with the environment. So while I come very much from a political ecology background, where you also have international political ecology, where there's a lot of attention for the political economy. Why are these agendas being pursued? Who profits from it? And really discovering what is the image and the discourse of the international in going around implementing military enforced green projects. We see this now in conservation, but you also see this happening a lot about carbon credits projects now, renewable energy projects, and the scope is getting larger and larger in different forms of this kind of green interventions that are often with a military approach. So political economy and international relations are very interesting to. It's important to understand those dynamics and the interest. But I found that still I'm very much drawn to literatures from environmental history of war. There's incredible, interesting work done on environmental anthropology of war. And that we really still need those lived experience and these lived realities to uncover what happened in the past and the present, and environmental histories and environmental anthropologies of war are for me very much theoretically interesting, but also very much about really uncovering the lived experience and to inform how to do research on green militarism. Because we can still criticize the international project, the international actors, but to really hold them to account, I think we need to know what are the effects on the ground and on the ecologies. And sometimes I feel international relations does not pay enough attention to actually going to specific areas and really to show how these international dynamics have consequences on the ground. For example, I'm really inspired by the work of Kali Rubai. Her work is very much on, she calls it forensic anthropology, and she wrote an article about the toxicated rivers of Iraq and how U.S. occupations and the war there have made that there is a huge toxification of the rivers. And then she describes in the article, beautiful, how well this became a river of death, about toxification, about destroying of life, how people still take care of that river, and how people actually see themselves as river protectors, and why and how the state then also deals with these people as seeing as activists, for example. And I'm really inspired by her work. She has more work on the public health effects of burn pits, for example, in Iraq, and to very much look at these long-term legacies and slimmering effects of the violence that even when militaries leave, when the US left, what is happening then still with the ecologies for over a longer period of time. And there, I think environmental historians, environmental anthropologists are really giving us that tool. But I still do feel very much for myself, I want to put the focus of my critique in my work to the international, or what is done, what is committed in my name, what is funded by the European Union, for example, and to really put my focus of critique on the political economy of what is sustaining those actions and who is also then held to responsible for these military cleanups after war, for example. And therefore, I do still engage a lot with international relations as well and unequal power relations and a lot of post-colonial theories, and to really show as well that, well, we can very much focus on the spectacularity of environment and war, and we get really drawn in the spectacle and looking at what's happening now in Gaza, of course, in Ukraine. But how is this also part of a longer historical process of dispossession, where actually warfare is always environmental? As environmental historian Emmanuel Krijke argues, warfare always has been environmental, and indigenous scholars has also said it for a long time, that the indigenous people in the US, in the Americas, for example, their livelihoods, the ecologies, the landscapes were destroyed, and that actually destroyed the people as well. And to see these current assaults on landscapes, on nature, should be seen in a longer historical perspective.
Thank you. There's a lot there. There's a lot for us to think about, I think, coming out of that. And hopefully people will be inspired to kind of consider these questions in their own work. Now, of course, this is the podcast of the European International Studies Association. And so our listeners are, of course, interested in international relations as a discipline broadly defined. And I think you've started to tell us this. But what can IR scholars learn from your work? You know, they should pay more attention to human nature relations. So what can they learn from your work? What can they learn from others' work who are researching these sort of nature society or nature human relations? Has IR been too anthropocentric in your thinking?
It's an interesting and provocative question. I don't think so. Yes and no, maybe. So I will explain myself. I don't think it is problematic that work is anthropocentric. I feel my own work is very much about people and military agendas making claims on landscapes, natures, and people's relationships with the environment in the time of colonization, but also now in the time of renewed, intensified global militarization we are seeing. So me, myself, my work is also quite anthropocentric because I'm not going very much in the more than human literature, which I do find very valuable. But I still find the questions of power and how actually humans have sought to control the environment, to control nature, not only to address, to control the environment, but also to control people. I don't find that aspect too problematic about IR. Well, I do think that the more than human turn that we see happening in anthropology, also political ecology, is very valuable. I'm actually still interested in the question how this military control over people and over nature, and how we actually can never separate those two, are creating less than human geographies. And that is still like depriving life from ecology, from nature, is also very much linked to depriving life and nature for certain people. And it's often whose life is being deprived. It's linked to colonization, it's marginalized people, it's necropolitics, like Achiume Mbembe said. It is necropolitics. What I do think is a problem with IR is sometimes that they kind of reinforce this dichotomy between nature and society. That society is something to study and nature is something to study as kind of separate domains. And this is a very Eurocentric legacy, and it's very often not intentionally, I think, because it was very much the modernization, the colonial project of separating nature from society. And by looking at war and militarization as something that is committed against urban centers, against people, and not looking and very much thinking, okay, the environment, how environments are being attacked, how nature is being destroyed is separate. That's the discussion around ecocide and genocide, for example. I think in IR, we still see a lot of talk that separates ecocide from genocide. Well, a lot of indigenous scholars and others say, actually, if we would decolonize the conception of ecocide, this ecocide is genocide, and that we can't separate the two. And I think IR can really see that if you study nature, that you start to see politics everywhere. And I think in Iris Braverman, her work on settler conservation is very interesting. In that book, she describes how the Israeli state is controlling nature, but through different ways, through nature conservation, through planting trees, reintroduction of certain species, that is all part of the settler colonial project. And it's about erasing Palestinian life and Palestinian nature and relation, and to really deny Palestinians their rootedness, their relationship with the environment, to very much rely on these Eurocentric forms of conservation about separating the environment and people. And she describes, and I quote her directly, that nature in the settler state's strongest weapon for territorial takeover. Nature's power lies precisely in its invisibility as such. Because the violence, the power, the territorial takeover, you can't see this when you just look at a tree. But when you start seeing this and you start to be aware of this, you see it everywhere. And I think, and I hope, that there are more people in IR starting to look nature and ecologies as kind of, as these political projects, and start to see the trees for the trees, but also as power and military projects.
Yeah, the trees is a big one, right? Because, I mean, who's against trees? Trees are great, right? And then you realize that actually planting trees, especially in Palestine, has been a way of occupying the landscape. But it's also incredibly environmentally damaging because a lot of them are not native species and they burn and they create forest fires. Anyway.
And then later, also tourism, like how then Israel start to organize its tourism, and by inviting tourists to do actually enjoy and visit those areas. Yeah. We in the tourists also became a way of further legitimizing and normalizing it.
Yeah, pressing. Okay. Yeah. So you have done a lot of field work over the years in the Eastern DRC. Again, not a depressing place. In and around Virunga National Park. So we've been talking about heavy stuff here, but maybe on a sort of lighter, more ethnographic note, if we can talk lightly about the Eastern DRC and, of course, all the violence that happens there. Do you have any interesting vignettes from your fieldwork that you could share with our listeners, or any important methodological insights for people who would be interested in doing the type of research that you do?
Yes. Well, of course, the situation, especially now in the east of the DRC, it's terrible and it's highly problematic, and it's a shame that there is not a lot of attention for it, and that this is ongoing for it's now entering the third decade of armed conflict. Yet, when I was doing most of my fieldwork in and around Virunga, it was a relatively calm period. So I don't want to hold here a very heroic narrative about like look how courageous I am going to east, to the east of the DRC for fieldwork, which is often a kind of image that's quickly assigned. I would tell you an anecdote that I sincerely never have felt unsafe in the DRC. I working together with a lot of Congolese researchers, activists, journalists have made me always very feel welcome and safe. And the moment of my research, I actually felt most intimidated when I was back in Brussels. And I wrote an article with colleagues that was kind of deconstructing the Netflix documentary Virunga that got nominated for an Oscar. And I got suddenly in the beginning of the evening a phone call of a former employee of the European Commission, highly advising me to change my narrative and to become less philosophical and become more pragmatic, and that my work is posing problems to continue their funding to the Virunga National Park. So I have been felt most intimidated within Brussels and what I call the believers of Virunga's project outside of Congo instead of inside of Congo. And one vignette from my fieldwork is that I actually, the interesting part is when I started my PhD, I did not think about looking at militarized conservation. I had not heard from it. I did not know political ecology literature. I was actually within international relations. I was looking at different EU state building and projects, security sector reform. And that was the focus of my PhD. Yet when the first time I came within Congo, everyone was talking around that the EU was financing this Virunga National Park, and people are telling, go back to Brussels and tell they are supporting the wrong thing because this is becoming very violent and the conflicts we have, the rangers are become more and more powerful, and it's actually, we have no ways to have dialogue with the park, and they're implementing the projects without our consent. And it was very much the willingness and the openness that everywhere where I came, people were actually talking about this. This was on top of their mind. This is an advice maybe for other people, is that I really shifted the focus of my PhD by really responding to what I found. And that did was actually the most a big factor of insecurity for them. And an EU intervention that as an international relations scholar that I was in conflict studies, I did not think about. Because I thought I'm going to look at police reform, all those aspects. But I didn't think about conservation as an international intervention. So it's really the people of Congo and the people I interviewed that actually made me shift my entire career.
I think that's really good advice, right? Being open to changing what you're researching, asking different questions on the basis of what you find in the field, being able to pivot. I now have visions of from Friends, people trying to pivot with a big, you know, remember that scene from Friends? Or maybe I'm just really old with this the sofa in the corridor, pivot. No, but I think it's a good advice, right? To be able to be guided by the people in the field. And I think it's also a good practice, right? I mean, it's a decolonial practice in a way, right? To not come and impose your sort of research agenda on a place and say, no, I'm definitely going to keep researching this EU, you know, security sector reform that, you know, you are not happy about, or you think about it in an entirely different way. So I think that's really good advice to our listeners, and especially to our maybe early career researchers who face these challenges, right? I think a lot of people face these challenges when they're starting out doing their research, and they don't necessarily know how to deal with this, or they get insecure about, you know, their project sort of perhaps moving in a different way. But I think your story is testament to that they should embrace that, and it can work very much in their favor, right? And they should take comfort from that. Now, you started to mention this, some of the stakeholders maybe ringing you up in the evening. That's kind of scary. So your research, you know, as you've mentioned, as you started to tell us, engages with a number of societal stakeholders. Hopefully they don't all phone you up at home. But how do you see your work influencing or contributing to discussions and debates beyond academia? So just sort of societal debates about conservation, about militarism.
Yeah, so over the years, I found it a really important part of my work, and it came a kind of natural in a certain way. And what I've seen happening over the years is that, well, in the beginning, people were still very much skeptical to think about the dark side of conservation. I think the debate has really changed. I think a lot of researchers, and not only me, because it's really like, let's not have illusions that we can change public opinion or agendas, one scholar at a time. The ask for collective and continuous engagement with other colleagues, of course, as well. But I do see a change in narrative. I do see many more media reports coming out that are highlighting this. Myself, I have been I've been interviewed quite a lot by international journalists, ranging from the New York Times to Al Jazeera, to also local journalists, also in the Netherlands. And I think, well, it was in the beginning, I need to talk a lot to kind of deconstruct the image and to really convince that people should not just being like embedded journalists and go being escorted by the armed park rangers and then for a few days and then tell their story and say, okay, maybe you can also spend a few days alone without the armed escort and you will get another story. And in the beginning, it took me a lot of work to convince that there are different narratives to look at and different people to interview instead of only the usual suspects. And this worked over time. I also have worked... I've talked with a lot of people of embassies, diplomats. There's more and more realization that fortress conservation, militarized conservation is not the future, that it should be community-led. There are being more and more rules about safeguarding human rights violations. And there has been a lot of scandals that came out over the years that have contributed to it. So I would not say this is very much only my work, but it's very much... work from people from all over different cases that continues to raise this issue, and I found it important to add to this debate. I do also organize because sometimes people think, oh, you're so critical of conservationists, you probably burned your bridges and they will not listen to you, or there's very much ideas that I am a very critical person and not easy to collaborate with. But actually, behind closed doors, there are a lot of local organizations that are very much respect for their work. I work with them. I try to also introduce them to the embassies and to the diplomats and say there are alternative actors you can work with. You don't have to go for the European-led organizations. There are Congolese organizations. There are Ugandan-led organizations. Now, I do also research in northeastern Uganda in the Karamoja region. There's an incredible organization doing important work there, like Karatunga. I really admire, if I see good examples, I also kind of really want to work together. And it's not just a kind of critique exercise. Where, to be honest, where I do think I have the biggest engagement with societal stakeholders is through... I work and I'm teaching at Wageningen University, which is it's a life science university, and social science. We are relatively small within that university, but I absolutely love to teach the students there. And for example, this semester I'm now teaching a course, Communities, Conservation, and Controversies, to 140 nature conservation and forest management students. They were also coming from animal sciences, from wildlife ecology. And there we are talking about the colonial history of conservation, around the importance of looking at gender, around continuous racism. We also talked about Israel uses in conservation as settler colonialism. And that for me is like, this is the new generation going to work in conservation policy and management, and often go actually do... really work on the ground, and that is really where I feel my engagement is having hopefully most impact for the future generation of conservationists.
I think that's an amazing place to end. I also feel like I feel like I'm always banging the drum about how teaching is actually where we have our biggest impacts, and we don't, I think, as an academic community, respect that enough, right? Because it's all about research metrics and research impact and all of these things. But I think teaching is absolutely where we can have the most impact. So I think that's a fantastic example. So thank you, Esther. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your candor with your answers. And hopefully people now have a better insight into green militarization, green militarism, conservation, nature-society relations, how they can think about that within their own work. So thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast. Feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.